Muhammad ibn Abdullah, and who is unknown. In the second narration, we have a person called Musa ibn Muhammad, who is weak. The third narration is Mursal, meaning some of the narrators are not mentioned. If you want to have a very quick answer to this Wahhabi scholar, the point is that none of these narrations are authentic. But addressing the content of the narration, I think this Wahhabi scholar has made two mistakes. The first mistake is that he thinks that the only person who was able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam after his birth was Hakima Khatun and no one else. And that is why he is only referring to the times that Hakima was able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. But the point is that we discussed in details in the previous programs that many of the companions of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam were able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So very to true. Give a key role only to Hakima Khatun in the story of the birth and occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is wrong. Mm-hmm. Because they want to prove that it was only her who saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, who knew about the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and all the stories are mentioned by him and no one else.
Wherever you be,
can it be because Hakima Khatun was a lady and this person wants to divert all the attention only to this respected lady?
Yeah.
And ladies and the women right has no place in the eyes of extremist groups.
That's the point.
From this viewpoint, from this angle, he wants to weaken the old hadith
and even he mentioned explicitly that the Shia has based his views about Mahdi on a report of a lady. Mm-hmm. He mentions that explicitly, as you mentioned, to undermine and to weaken this belief and teaching. So the point is that this is not the case. We have met many other people. We mentioned the names in the previous programs. The second mistake...
And even if it was only this single lady who witnessed it, it had no problem, because Maryam salamullah alayhi was the only lady who knew the story of Isa. I mean, the story
That's
of
true.
Birth
I mean,
of Isa.
I mean,
so ladies are different than ladies in the world. Even the respect of the lady should be
That's
in its
true,
own
but
place.
When it comes to the narration, if you have, I mean, there is no difference between the narrations that we receive from a lady or from a man. I mean, from this perspective, there is no difference. We
Very
have
true.
Narrations from the ladies in Shia collections of hadith. But yeah. The point is that if there is only her, then some people might call it Khabar Wahid, one narration narrated only by one
person. Same applies for men as well.
Yeah. The same applies for men. But we said that this is not Khabar Wahid. Many people
Very
have
true.
Seen Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, so it's kind of mutawatir narration, meaning narrated through various chains of the narration. But the second and the main mistake is that he has thought that the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam in the minor occultation was all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And not gradual. But we believe that the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, I mean, the fact that he disappeared from eyes of the people in the minor occultation was something gradual. Let me explain it in more details. When we talk about the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, we mean that Imam did not appear in front of the people.
Mm-hmm.
It could be all at once, but the historical reports and the narrations tell us that it was somehow gradual. So, for example, it is mentioned that some of the Shia of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, they saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam one day after his birth, Kamaluddin, page 430.
True.
In another narration, 7 days after his birth, Kamaluddin, 431. 40 days after his birth, Kitab al-Ghiba by Sheikh al-Tusi, page 237. 2 days before martyrdom of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, Kitab al-Ghiba, page 239. Some days after the martyrdom of the Imam, Imam al-Askari, Kamaluddin, 453. And again, after the martyrdom of Imam Asqar alayhi salam, Kamaluddin, page 473. So to think that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam disappeared from the eyes of all the Shia all at once, it is something wrong, and it is rejected by the narrations. The Shia needed time to come to this conclusion that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam will go to a minor occultation and then the major occultation. So some of them were able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam after his birth, some after 7 days, 40 days after the martyrdom of Imam Asqar alayhi salam. So the point is that it was gradual, so that Shia get used to that. So that is why we see that Sheikh al-Mufid is one of the scholars who believe that the minor occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam began at the time of the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. But then he narrates some stories in which some of the Shia were able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam in his minor occultation. So what is the conclusion? The conclusion is that Sheikh al-Mufid believes minor occultation begins in 255. But again, some Shia are able to see the Imam. So this kind of, this notion of disappearance of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam from the eyes of the Shia was something gradual. It did not happen all at once. True. Also, we see that Sheikh al-Saduq and Sheikh al-Tusi, they have narrated these narrations which are mentioned by these Wahhabi scholars. But beside that, they have mentioned many stories according to which many Shia, many companions of Imam al-Asqar alayhi salam were able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. For example, the dear listeners can refer to Kamaluddin by Sheikh al-Saduq, page 434, and also Kitab al-Ghibah by Sheikh al-Tusi, page 229. So the point is that according to these scholars, the beginning of the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is not the last visit of Hakim Khatun with Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. I think we need to continue our discussion in our upcoming session. Time is almost over and we have to finalize the discussion here. We have been talking about the hadith and narrations that emphasize the beginning and the starting point of occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And it was witnessed that Imam was seen by different companions, including Lady Hakim Khatun, salamullah alayha. And this will be, inshallah, continued in our upcoming session. Sheikh Nasr, thank you very much. And you, respected listeners, many thanks for staying tuned and listening to The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. We'll meet again in our next session. I'd like to invite you to join us again. Till then, I'll leave you in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Allahumma
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hasan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
Reporters. The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white majority countries. The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated. Because in reality, we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in our classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, you black so-and-so. Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form, or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh, well, we've come a long way. We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among black, Asian, and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, urged Saudi Arabia to immediately end its war on Yemen and lift its blockade on its southern neighbor. Said Nasrallah called on Saudi Arabia not to waste time by proposing deceiving initiatives which lead to nowhere and stressed that stopping the war and the blockade should be simultaneous. Nasrallah also warned of a Saudi plot to blame Yemen's Ansarullah movement for the ongoing conflict in the war-torn country.
You need to stop the war and end the blockade. Then we can sit and negotiate. Here's where the deception lies. What does it mean if you stop the war without ending the blockade? It means that what they could not realize through a military war, they want to achieve through humanitarian and social pressure.
Elsewhere in his remarks, he said the U.S. is not as strong as before and is on a path toward collapse while the axis of resistance is gaining power.
America is no longer the America that you knew. There is one main issue that Imam Khamenei has stressed in the last year, and I call on everyone in the region to ponder on that thought. That is the decline of the U.S. America is taking the downward path.
Speaking at an event commemorating late Sheikh Ahmad al-Zin, who was a pioneer in clerics who spoke for Palestine, Nasrallah stressed that the so-called deal of the century has died as a result of the Palestinian people's patience. Observers believe Sayyid Nasrallah's view shows that there is an opportunity for the entire region, even for the Saudis, to be able to stop the crisis of the war they launched on Yemen.
The speech of Sayyid Hassan shows that all regional sides enjoy an opportunity to hold on to their principles and at the same time preserve their achievements. This is true even with the issue of Islamic Republic of Iran and its nuclear program. All of these developments can pave the way for achieving political results.
Hezbollah leader also warned regional countries against relying on the United States. Hezbollah's leader then touched upon the political impasse in Lebanon, calling for the immediate formation of a new government. Hezbollah Secretary General has stressed in his speech that most of the wars in the region, namely in Syria or Yemen, are mainly aimed to target the resistance and the Palestinian cause and to create a Sunni-Shiite rift. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The prosecution in Sheikh Zazaki's trial finally completed the presentation of witnesses when the trial resumed in a Kaduna High Court, where the Islamic cleric is standing trial for culpable homicide and other charges, which he pleaded not guilty. The prosecution lawyer expressed the hope that he will get a conviction following the presentation of credible witnesses.
We presented about 15 witnesses for the prosecution. 15 top army generals that were key actors, key players in the whole of the saga that led to the filing of the charges against Balaam Sheikh Zaki. One of our prayers is that the court should overrule the no-case submission, overrule the defense, and convict the defendants accordingly and pass the necessary sentence as provided for.
However, Zazaki's defense team dismissed the claim of the prosecution as it affirmed an earlier position that there shouldn't even have been a case against the Islamic cleric.
So far, based on the evidence advanced thus far, all the 15 witnesses so far, in our estimation, has not made any submission or given any evidence that incriminates the defendant in any manner whatsoever. So it's on that basis that we will be entering the no-case submission.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat have been in detention for over 5 years despite the ruling of a federal high court ordering for their release. Over 340 of Sheikh Zazaki's supporters were killed, including three of his biological sons, when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center in December 2015. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat are detained in the Kaduna Correctional Facility, not far from this courthouse where the trial is taking place. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has just turned 70, and his supporters are calling for his immediate and unconditional release. Danjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
The European-wide Islamophobia epidemic has shown little sign of curbing as more countries join the criticized burqa ban. Swiss Muslims have been the latest to feel the effects of hate after a referendum passed banning all face coverings in public spaces.
Being free is to be able to show our face, respect women's dignity, have our own identity, and therefore I do not understand the discourse of people who want to imprison women behind this veil.
Following the ban, I reached out to Zainab, a German national who travels regularly to Switzerland, and asked how the ban has impacted her.
This ban makes me really sad and angry because it's the second article here in the federal constitution against the Islam. I think we have to understand that it's not against the niqab or against the minaret. It's against the global Islam. It's just an Islamophobia act. And I think they are not finished. They are looking for the next step.
The ban isn't the first anti-Islam move adopted by the Swiss, as I found out after speaking to the Islamic Central Council of Switzerland.
I just can confirm you, I mean, Swiss chocolate is great. Even we Muslims, we love it. And Toblerone is now even halal, so it's a great thing, yeah? In terms of Islamophobia, this is less great, yes, indeed. Actually, we are indeed suffering since 2009, when this first referendum came up against the minarets, which has been indeed banned with 57.3% of the Swiss population voting yes for this ban. We are constantly, during the last 10 years as a community, have been attacked by the media, have been the target of certain stereotypes.
Local campaigners and activists have vowed to fight back against the ban. However, the global Muslim attention fixed elsewhere. the defenders of Islam in Switzerland have yet to receive the support they deserve.
The reasons behind enforcing the ban vary from country to country, with some claiming it's a security threat, while others simply say that it contradicts Western ideals. Now, whatever the excuse, the traumatizing effect that the ban has on devout Muslim women has been made clear by those who suffer from its enforcement. Robert Carter, London.
The Bayt al-Futuh Mosque in London, one of the largest in Western Europe, hosting a pop-up vaccine clinic to boost inoculation rates and overcome vaccine hesitancy amid the many myths that have been created around the pandemic.
NHS approached us, and they said with the idea of a pop-up clinic here, vaccination clinic, and you know, we welcomed it. Our community has had an abnormally high number of people that have suffered from the virus.
We dispel the myths about microchips and blood clots and answer their queries. Some are really concerned about their fertility.
British scientists say there is a historical trend of lower vaccine uptake in areas with a higher proportion of ethnic minority groups in England.
A recent study found that a high percentage of people from Pakistani or Bangladeshi origin said they were unlikely to be vaccinated. Among black Britons, the figure stands at more than 40%, the highest of all ethnic groups in this country, meaning that some of the most vulnerable people are the least likely to get the jab.
And that's a concern for the British government, which plans to inoculate every adult in the country with the first dose of the vaccine by the end of summer. Online videos distorting people's understanding of the virus and the vaccines abound. This one, that claimed silver solution kills the virus, was proved false by a news channel. Conspiracy theories have deepened public distrust in medical science.
Well, I think there's been some indication amongst South Asians for the Indian community that there might be some element of beef in the vaccine, that it might be unsafe. Particularly, there's been those questions of whether there's any pork content, porcine content, pig content to the vaccine, which there is not. But those rumours have been going amongst the Pakistani community in particular, which is large in our country, and they are false accusations.
Among some black Britons, a sense of unease. They don't trust the government. Some fear there might be different vaccines for black and white people. This week, a video featuring high-profile black figures urging black Britons to take the vaccine.
But we're asking you to trust the facts about the vaccine from our own professors, scientists, and doctors.
Vaccine hesitancy also extends to ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities, mostly over fears it might contain pork, or from the perspective of this controversial rabbi, popular on YouTube, it might alter people's sexual orientation. Conspiracy theorists exploit a lack of trust in the government and a health system that to some ethnic minorities appears to favor white people and the more affluent. The British government's challenge now is to build trust in the vaccines proven to save lives. Saeed Pariza, London.
Following a late cabinet meeting, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced his government's decision to reinstate a total lockdown on weekends in most Turkish states. The decision came after the number of daily infections with coronavirus reached more than 30,000. Erdogan also stated that during the holy month of Ramadan, the weekend lockdown and daily curfew from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. will continue, with restaurants only serving delivery and takeouts.
During the month of Ramadan, restaurants and cafes in Turkey will only be allowed to deliver food as part of the measures against the COVID-19 pandemic, as weekend curfews will again be in place on Saturdays.
A week ago, Turkish president had refused to tighten restrictions. He said, although the number of daily infections is high, the number of those hospitalized is less. Some criticize what they call the government's double standards in dealing with the situation, as it is preventing wedding parties and home visits, while the ruling party is organizing conferences to promote for 2023 elections.
Of course,
infection rates will continue to rise due to the majority not abiding by the instructions. For example, when the government eased restrictions on restaurants and cafes and were all allowed to operate without preventive frameworks, people and restaurants themselves did not abide by the measures. However, you cannot ask people to be careful and follow restriction guidance when you hold popular gatherings to promote your party for the elections. This contradicts your own statements and measures. On the one hand, they stress the need to adhere to social distancing and the use of protective masks, and on the other, they organize public conferences with public attendance.
Turkish president said that 80% of Turkey's citizens live in high-risk provinces, including the capital Ankara and the biggest city in the country, Istanbul. The government now hopes that by the end of the holy month of Ramadan, the majority of Turkish citizens and residents would be vaccinated so that Turkey can welcome tourists again. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A new report on household debt by the Bank of Italy has highlighted that some 40% of Italian households are struggling to pay the rent amid economic difficulties linked to the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. According to the report, a large number of indebted families, 3 out of 10, and individuals, 4 out of 10, have said they are having trouble keeping up the payment of their rents or mortgage installments.
The work situation has worsened significantly, particularly for those who had a casual part-time job. For many, it's hard even to make ends meet. Bear in mind that pupils were forced to follow their classes online up to last week, and also for this reason, families have been under huge pressure.
Besides the economic impact of COVID restrictions, there are increasing concerns regarding the obvious effects on people's mental health. Many simply cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Not long ago, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, warned that some 5.6 million people were recorded as living in absolute poverty in Italy in 2020, an increase of about 1 million over the previous year. About 300,000 small and mid-sized firms that are especially vulnerable to the business disruptions inflicted by the pandemic have gone bankrupt.
Italy was in dire financial straits before the COVID-19 pandemic struck. It was the only G7 country not to have seen its economic growth return to pre-2007 levels after the global financial crisis, and its per capita income is the same as 23 years ago.
The health minister said all non-essential shops will stay closed for the entire month of April, even if the situation rolls back to normal. We disagreed with this approach. Shop must reopen. Italian must get back to work.
Meanwhile, a solidarity initiative to support poor families hit by the pandemic has been officially launched by the National Farmers Association Coldiretti. At least 20,000 households struggling in the middle of the pandemic will be receiving high-quality food products to ensure good meals during Easter festivities. Max Civili, Rome.
Along with a series of events held by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip to mark the Land Day, Palestinian students and youth community also organized a conference. Students, residents, activists, and resistance leaders attended the conference, which was held in connection with several countries around the world to support the Palestinian cause.
We are marking the 45th anniversary of the Land Day, while about 25 countries around the world are participating to voice their support for Palestinian cause. We are stressing on our right of return to our lands and that Jerusalem al-Quds will remain the capital of Palestine. People who marked Land Day proved they will keep fighting the Israeli occupation to gain their rights.
On the eastern parts of the enclave, near the separation fence, Palestinians also held an event stressing on their right of return to the occupied lands. They also expressed their refusal for the recent normalization of ties with Israel and considered it as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
We stress that Israeli occupiers will leave our land by force, and Palestinian resistance won't remain silent against Israeli violations of Palestinian land and rights. We call on the world to stop the normalization of ties with Israel that gives Israel a green light to keep up its inhuman aggression and crimes against Palestinians.
We are proving that we won't give up defending our land. What happened on this day is unforgettable, and we stress that we won't allow Israel to take over our Palestinian lands. We mark this day to express that the resistance is our way to defend Palestine and force the Israeli occupation to leave.
Land Day is marked every year by Palestinians since March 30, 1976, to honor those who fell while defending their lands from being illegally seized by the Israeli government. When Israel declared its intention to annex approximately 5,000 acres of land from its Palestinian owners in several villages. The Land Day comes as Palestinians are calling the international community to stop the Israeli expansionism and land grab, vowing they will keep fighting until liberating Palestine and its capital, Jerusalem al-Quds. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
France is responsible but not complicit in the Rwandan genocide. That's the main conclusion of a report on the Rwandan genocide that the official Duclair Commission submitted to French President Emmanuel Macron. In 1994, extremist militia from Rwanda's Hutu ethnic group slaughtered more than 800,000 people from their own ethnic group as well as the Tutsis minority in a matter of 3 months. France intervened before, during and after the genocide, but not to prevent it. François Granet, who is the author of The French State and the Genocide of the Tutsi in Rwanda, says the French government's report into the issue does not go far enough.
From 1990 to 1995, French decision-makers decided to maintain Rwanda in their zone of influence. They decided to arm the regime and to support the Hutus extremists against Tutsi before, during, and even after the genocide. The French authorities had been perfectly informed on the issue. Even if France did not have any intention to commit genocide, the French support had an undeniable facilitating effect on the Hutus extremists.
Experts have proof that French authorities received many alerts during the ongoing genocide. In this video shot in Rwanda during the genocide, a French sergeant warns the French Army's chief of special operations that Tutsis are being massacred not far from where they are. But the French colonel does not react.
Complicity
means help, and France allows the creation of an extremist government and its recognition by the international community. The perpetrators of genocide are welcome in France, and they find shelter in France and in Belgium once the genocide is completed. France delivers weapons before, during, and after the genocide. All this means political complicity.
Rwanda is a small country, mostly agricultural, with very few natural resources. No big deal. So why this was of interest to France?
France gives the support to dictators. If one goes down, the others will not trust France anymore. In the beginning of France-Afrique in the 60s, France abandoned one dictator and the consequences were catastrophic. Mitterrand and other French presidents swore not to abandon any other African dictator.
The report on Paris's role in the Rwandan genocide has other downsides besides trying to obscure France's real role. The probe was carried out with Parliament, where Macron's allies have a majority, refusing to give investigators full access to relevant archives. This new report highlights the responsibility of France in the genocide in Rwanda. However, this National Assembly refused to open all the archives, and French authorities still do not want to admit their complicity in the genocide. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked an...
The Holy Prophet of Islam
is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned.
دی هم هستن میترسن از گناهانشون از اعمال و کردارشون میترسن.
There are some people who are afraid of their deeds. Their sense of fear is right, because all the prophets and the Ahlul Bayt talked about the effects of our deeds in this world and the hereafter. The philosophy behind the creation of the hereafter is exactly this: to be given the reward or punishment for our deeds in this world. Some people are fearful because of the consequences of their deeds, because they were not successful in serving Allah.
حالا همه ما میگیم ما بنده خدا هستیم، اما بنده یعنی سر خود کاری نمیکنه.
We all claim to be the servant of Allah. However, a true servant does not do anything upon his own desires. All of the deeds and manners of true servants are according to the orders of Allah. Whatever our Master Allah says, we must say yes. There is no self-decision here. All your decisions are related to your Master in order to satisfy Him. This means that whatever Allah wants, you want too. Unfortunately, few of the people acted like true servants, and most of us were after reaching our own desires in this world. We only followed our own wishes and hopes. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please do log into our website, which is parsetoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Risks shoot up when virus particles accumulate in buildings, but it's not clear how best to improve ventilation, says Diane Lewis, author, in an article published under the heading, Why Indoor Spaces Are Still Prime COVID Hotspots. Stay tuned for more. When Lydia Morozka leaves home, she takes with her a slick shoe-sized device that provides some sobering insights about the restaurants and offices she visits. Outside these buildings, her carbon dioxide monitor reads just above 400 parts per million, but indoors is a different story. Even in a seemingly spacious, high-ceilinged restaurant, the number sometimes shoots up as high as 2,000 ppm, a sign that the room has poor ventilation and could pose a risk for COVID-19 infection. Visual cues can be deceptive, even for Morozka, an aerosol scientist from Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. The general public has no idea about this, she says. The situation is no different inside cafes or kindergartens around much of the world, according to researchers who have wielded similar handheld CO2 meters. And that's bad news for hopes of defeating the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2. For months, health authorities have singled out indoor spaces with poor ventilation as potential infection hotspots. And on March 1st, the World Health Organization, WHO, released a long-awaited roadmap to better ventilation. The document, which Morozka contributed to, sets out specific targets and measures that businesses and other places can take to improve ventilation and make buildings safer. But Philomera Blusin, a building engineer at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, says that more needs to be done. The WHO guidelines, she says, are the minimum. Hussein and others are critical of government's failure to provide clear guidance or money for people to make indoor spaces safer. Some scientists say that has been large swathes of the population, from school children to office workers, restaurant goers and prisoners, at risk of catching COVID-19. Others say that there is no easy fix, and the precise ventilation or air purification regimes to make indoor spaces safe are not known. The complexity is not at a level that you can, with a simple set of advice, resolve it, says Ehsan Mousavi, a construction engineer at Clemson University in South Carolina, who studies indoor air quality and ventilation in hospitals. Still, many experts say that enough is known for authorities to provide clear message about how important good ventilation is for safety indoors, especially in spaces that are continuously occupied or where masks are removed when eating. On March 28, 2020, 2 months after the WHO had declared COVID-19 a global health emergency, the agency broadcast a public health message on Twitter and Facebook. Fact: COVID-19 is not airborne, it said, labeling claims to the contrary as misinformation. But evidence quickly established that the virus is transmitted by air, and researchers roundly criticized the agency. WHO updated its advice on SARS-CoV-2 transmission 3 months later, acknowledging the possibility that airborne transmission might occur in some community settings. Airborne transmission in crowded and inadequately ventilated spaces over a prolonged period of time with infected persons cannot be ruled out, the updated advice says. Yuku Li, a building environment engineer at the University of Hong Kong, says that he is disappointed it took the WHO and other health authorities so long. We would have saved a lot of people if airborne transmission was recognized earlier, he says. A WHO spokesperson says the agency has mentioned the importance of ventilation since early in the pandemic. Others say that the WHO's position still doesn't go far enough. Airborne transmission is dominant, says environmental epidemiologist Joseph Allen at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, Massachusetts. That's why building controls such as ventilation and air filtration makes sense, he says. The WHO and other health authorities have failed to clearly prioritize measures to improve indoor air quality to reduce the chance of catching COVID-19, says Jose Luis Jimenez, an atmospheric chemist at the University of Colorado at Boulder. They don't emphasize how important it is, he says. What the WHO needs to say is, fact, it goes through the air, says Jimenez. We breathe it in. A stark message from the WHO would ensure that national health authorities take notice, says Jimenez. Australia, the Netherlands, and some other nations still do not acknowledge in their public statement that airborne transmission has a significant role in spreading the SARS-CoV virus. By the start of this year, concerns over ventilation had reached the boiling point. Hundreds of healthcare workers, scientists, engineers, and occupational health and safety experts signed open letters calling on government officials in Canada, the United States, Australia, Colombia, and the UK to address, among other things, poor indoor air quality. These concerted campaigns all urged local or national governments to take steps to reduce airborne transmission of SARS
SARS-CoV-2. One of the problems is that governments and businesses are still spending millions of dollars on surface disinfection, says Jimenez, despite evidence that it is rare for SARS-CoV-2 to pass from one person to another through contaminated surfaces. By contrast, few countries have invested in measures to improve indoor air quality. If we took half the efforts that's been given to disinfection and we put it on ventilation, that will be huge, Jimenez says. In October, Germany set aside 500 million euros to improve ventilation in public buildings, including schools, museums, and public offices. Businesses in Germany and South Korea can also apply for government funding to purchase mobile air purifiers that remove virus-laden aerosols. In the United States, by contrast, federal funding to improve indoor air quality was limited to healthcare providers such as hospitals until the American Rescue Plan Act, which also provides funding for schools, became law on March 11th. What makes indoor spaces so dangerous is that the virus can accumulate and infect people who do not have direct contact with an infected person. A prime example happened a year ago in Vietnam. 12 people became infected at a restaurant, but only 4 had close contact with the infected person. More recent outbreaks at gyms in Chicago, Illinois, and Hawaii have also occurred despite physical distancing of the attendees and capacity limits on fitness classes. Ever since the WHO acknowledged last year that airborne transmission could happen, public health agencies have emphasized the risk in crowded and poorly ventilated spaces. But the terminology is deceptive, says Morosco. You imagine a busy restaurant, she says. In reality, any place can become crowded and poorly ventilated, and people don't realize this. Her own modestly sized office at the Queensland University of Technology quickly becomes poorly ventilated if someone visits and the door is closed, she says. And spacious, uncrowded restaurants can appear to be well ventilated when they are not. It's one of the reasons that Jimenez and others advocate the use of inexpensive CO2 monitors as a rough measure of whether ventilation is adequate or not. As virus-carrying aerosols are exhaled, so too is CO2. And when ventilation is poor, CO2 accumulates along with the virus, says Jimenez. In an unreviewed analysis, Jimenez and his co-author Zhi Peng found that SARS-CoV-2 infection risk rises along with CO2 concentrations indoors.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, two things cause destruction. If we consider the causes of increase in transgression, larcenies, theft, cheating, and plundering, we find that the following two factors are the root of all these events. Some people, having everything, commit offenses only for the fear of poverty and obsession for securing the future. And some others sacrifice their peace of mind and soul in order to acquire fanciful honors. Giving up these destructive traits allow man to enjoy inner peace and happiness. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, "Two things destroy people, fear of poverty and seeking of fanciful honors." Brothers and sisters, when we look at our own lives, let's just introspect for a while, you know, and then look at people around us, look at the society we live in. Aren't these two factors playing a vital role in changing our worldview and changing our decision-making process? Do we not run after wealth even if we have enough and sufficient for ourselves? Why? Because we fear poverty. And then at the same time, we spend all that wealth just for those fanciful, artificial, and superficial honors. We want to be respected in the society. These things are prevalent issues of contemporary society, which is based on materialism. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we want to discuss this thing a bit more, where the fear of poverty is destroying our societies. Well, how do we treat this? What needs to be done in order for people to come out of this whirlpool, right? We're going to list out a few of the ideas just to get you thinking about the solutions to this potential issue of our societies. The first one is teaching people to believe truly that provisions come from Allah. Allah is the Raziq. Allah is the provider. Number two, seeking refuge with Allah from poverty. You know, poverty is not something that we should be seeking. Now, of course, we need to avoid it. But how do we avoid it? By running after the world? No. We have to seek refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and make sure that we don't get deceived by this evil of the society. Number three, encouragement to work and earn a living and to travel in the land to seek provision. Number four, making zakah obligatory on the wealth of the rich. This Islamic taxes, zakat and khums, you know, these are the Islamic taxes. If they're made obligatory, it solves a lot of the problems we see in the society. Number five, encouragement to give charity. Set up waqfs and sponsor orphans and widows. Number six, prohibition on riba, usury, gambling, and deceit in selling. These are the diseases of human society. Last but not the least for today's program is encouragement to help the needy and support the weak. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.